For KFSK Public Radio News, I'm Matt Lichtenstein with a local veteran's story in honor of Memorial Day. Last week, I spoke with a World War II veteran who served aboard a crash boat in the Aleutian Islands. His unit's primary purpose was the rescue of pilots who had crashed in the frigid waters on the way to and from bombing missions over the Pacific. Petersburg's Gerald Lind went into maritime service after graduating high school.
In 1943, I graduated from high school here, and half of the boys in our class just marched out of the ceremonies and got on a boat, went to Juneau, and went into the service. And the other half of us tried to get into the Coast Guard or whatever and catch a can. Then on down to Seattle and went into the maritime service. It's called the Army Transportation Corps.
After a few months of working on tugs and barges, Lind enlisted and went through basic training and specialized training with the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS. In California, in the fall of 1944, he joined up with a crew of 104-foot and 85-foot vessels, which were on their way to the Aleutians to join the 11th Army Air Force's 10th Rescue Boat Squadron, the crash boats.
I wound up coming north on a 749, 104-footer, and at ADAC, I was transferred onto the 518, and the 518 and the 510 were stationed out at Attu, and we'd run over to Shemya, lay at Shemya Dock, which is, the dock got washed out of there every time it turned around until towards the last part of the war.
The 518 was one of a number of newer, faster 85-foot vessels. The long, narrow boats resembled the smaller submarine chasers or torpedo boats of the time, and they were fast, traveling at speeds of up to 39 knots and cruising at 25. The crew had to live aboard the vessel, so it was ready at a moment's notice in the event of a crash. They were built for speed, not for comfort.
We were a floating bomb. We had 4,500 to 5,000 gallons of high-octane fuel in this tank all the time, and our only heating system was one of those aircraft heaters that you'd see sitting out in the aprons at the airports with these big funny-looking flexible hoses heating up the engines. Well, we had stovepipe running from the back end in the cockpit back by the 20-millimeter cannon, and you have to get up to have some heat. You had to go out and light that high-powered furnace, and it'd come out of those stovepipe openings like it's like a torch hitting you.
In the Aleutians, the biggest enemy of the war was the weather. The wind and storms of the Aleutians are notorious, and Lynn says the fog was persistent.
There's a lot of fog that'll just lay there. Some days it won't blow for 4 or 5 days, and then all of a sudden it won't stop for 8, 10 days. You know, it just starts to blow underneath the fog, and the fog seems to stay there. It's just crazy. Usually wind will blow it away. So that's the biggest part of the war out there was weather. It's how the Japanese snuck in and snuck out, and how everybody either lost their lives, and hundreds of guys that lost their lives and trying to get the planes from one island to the next.
The squadron of boats laid in wait throughout the islands ready to pick up flyers who had survived crashes after takeoff or on their return from bombing and reconnaissance missions. The Japanese had invaded and occupied Attu and Kiska Islands in the Aleutians in the early summer of 1942. In the only campaign of the war fought on North American ground, the U.S. retook the islands in the spring and summer of 1943. U.S. forces suffered particularly heavy casualties in Attu due to battle and the harsh weather conditions. When Lind arrived in the Aleutians in 1944, the 11th Air Force was busy attacking Japanese shipping and military installations in the northern Kurile Islands. Lind says the flights were constant.
As far as constant action, it was Shemya and Attu were the two main, because they had the B-24 bombers going continuously off of Shemya, and on Attu they had the Navy PVs and some B-25s on both of them. And they had P-38s and P-40s, and most all P-38 pursuit planes. So those planes flew protection for the bombers, and they were going daily. I mean, this was a war zone.
Lynn says each rescue situation was different, but like a number of crash boats in the latter part of the war, he says the 518 only had a few rescues.
Not a one of them had any relationship to the other, other than the fact we didn't have many. I mean, I think we had a total of 3 pilots for our boat. And I know some guys give up. They didn't have any, I mean, as far as getting any, because usually it was just oil slick or, like I said, that one bad one off of the Navy PV didn't get really going very well. It was up about 200 feet when it lost control of itself or lost power and landed right 200 yards from us and blew, and all we could do was pick up pieces, you know.
When they got to a downed pilot, pulling him in the boat was not easy. Lynn says the 85-footers had no davits or winches at the time, and the flyers were too stiff from the cold to help themselves on a ladder, so the crew used a net.
We didn't have any means of getting the guys aboard other than a landing net. So what we did, every time each time, I should say, because it's so few, we'd pull up alongside and put this net over the side of the boat, and two guys would jump in the water. Get the pilot or whoever it was, because we figured everybody, even if he was moving, we were trained this way that you just couldn't let him move much, because we went on the assumption that they were human beings for 5 to 10 minutes, and after 15 minutes, they were not really people anymore. And death would occur within minutes after that.
The crash boat crew figured they had 15 to 30 minutes to save a fellow's life once he hit the freezing water.
Well, we had one pilot that we picked up. He'd been in the water for 40 minutes, and his pulse was 10, and he made it. We had nothing like you have now as far as equipment to treat people like that. But we did have electric suits, like long johns, long underwear.
That was one of the methods used to warm up survivors, and for those survivors rescued by the 518, it was quite a sight as the vessel approached. The crew had painted a distinctive set of gaping, sharp-toothed jaws on the bow, similar to the scheme seen on famous fighter planes of the time, like the P-40 Warhawk.
I don't know, I can't remember to this day whose idea it was, and the next thing I knew, they were painting merrily away up there. That was when we had come from Attude back to Adak, because we had crushed in our bow trying to save the boat in a 140-mile-an-hour wind. And it came from South Pacific, I guess, because there was a few P-40s out there. And somebody got this bright idea that we're going to have that, and they painted it on there. And this one pilot that we... As a matter of fact, it was the guy that his pulse was 10 when he got out of the hospital there and was walking around. He and several other pilots, they came down and they had a bottle with them or two. They were going to thank us and so forth. He said, "That is an awful sight to see that thing coming straight at you." He said, "It's just like a big wild whale, killer whale or something." So. But it was, everybody knew what boat we were.
The boat was skippered and crewed by enlisted men. While there was plenty of gasoline, Lynn says it was not easy to get other supplies, but that changed after a visiting general decided to take a tour on the 518.
He'd come down to see what was going on, what's this crash boat business. And he had his entourage with him, there were 3-4 guys, and we took out of there, and he was impressed with, we could untie and be on the way. We were always ready, we had to be, and the engines were always warm. In 60 seconds, we were free of the float. We were tied to a steel float barge, actually. And in 60 seconds, we were out of there, and 60 seconds later, we were doing 35 knots, and he was impressed. Well, he decided he wanted to go out for a longer run, because it was a nice day. And we got out there off the north end of Attui. He wanted to see the radar outpost out there. So we kept right on going. Well, noontime came, time to eat lunch. We hadn't planned on this, and the guys hadn't been up to the headquarters or whatever they call the dispensary for food. And we didn't have anything. We had onions and crackers and, I can't remember, Spam.
Lynn says the general was upset, asking the cooks about why they had no food.
He started quizzing these two cooks of ours. One was a real comedian. He kept us sane. He anything he said or did was funny. It was just crazy. And he interviewed those guys, and from that time on, those two and the same two off of the 510, they could go up to the officers' grocery department and get anything that the officers' club and the officers' mess could have. And did we ever live it up after that? We were having steak and eggs and all kinds of things.
The crash boats were a relatively new program at the outset of World War II, and Lynn says there had been some question of having boats in the Air Force, but the idea was proven in the English Channel, and the boats served in many capacities, from critical rescues to morale-boosting missions.
Nobody knew anything about boats. What do you want a boat in the Air Force for? Well, as it turned out, like the English showed how efficient they were in picking up people in that short channel they had to cross, only 30 miles there, you know. In our case, we were operating in the wildest weather in the world, an open ocean, and from that, they found out, and we were displaced by what we now have as helicopters. We did all the same work as the helicopters do now. We transported USO troops. We went out and picked up appendicitis cases, guys that went out of their head on these remote outposts. One time we even took a whole bunch of officers out salmon fishing. We couldn't get over that one.
Many of the crew members on the various Aleutian crash boats were Alaskans, young men just out of high school who had grown up on the water. Throughout the war, 10 Petersburg residents served in the 10th Rescue Boat Squadron, formed by Major Gordon Donnelly, who trained the crews near Ketchikan. Lynn is very proud of the role Petersburg residents played in the crash boat squadrons and other military services during World War II. I ask him to share his thoughts for Memorial Day.
Well, I think the people have recently, because of 9/11, learned that we as a nation have to stand together and be proud of our nation. And I think our local boys, all the Navy guys, the Air Force, the Army Transport Service, this town lost, or not lost, but they put over 200 people into service in World War II. Out of a little town of population at that time of about 1,200, something of that nature. So the hardships of war nobody knows in this country yet until 9/11 got a little taste of it. And even when we didn't have anything in every town, in every city in the United States, we had foreigners on our soil. And Petersburg stood tall in that. And I have a list of guys here. These fellas were in the 10th Rescue Boat Squadron. There's George Nicholson, Tom Thompson, Erling Nicholson, and Bruce McKechnie, Pete Tinas, Erling Tinas, Stan Reed, Art Hammer, Spencer Ilzelson, Dan Vick, Art Tweeten, and myself. Just in one outfit. They knew that they grew up, these people grew up on the water or in the water in skiffs and so forth, and that's what Major Donnelly wanted, and that's how he formed his nucleus of his crash rescue boat squadron.
The 10th was just one of many rescue boat squadrons. Lynn says there were over 500 crash boats in use throughout World War II and the Korean War. Rescuing pilots anywhere an airfield was near water. For KFSK News, I'm Matt Lichtenstein. Today's Memorial Day services will be held at the cemetery at 3 p.m. in Petersburg.